everybody, and welcome back to another podcast from Sinful Cinema. I'm the Reverend Phantom, and as always, I am joined by TL Bug.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to podcast number 4. Can you believe we've made it to 4?
No.
I can't either, but we're almost on Solid Food exclusively now, because we're 4. Next podcast, we'll be going to kindergarten.
And we got a whole bunch of stuff to throw at you tonight, and some good reviews for Sugar Hill from 1974, a blaxploitation zombie movie. Not many of those.
Not at all. And we also have a review of Runaway with Tom Selleck. I guess you do probably expect a Tom Selleck review on this show, but you're going to get one.
And it also features Gene Simmons. You got to mention that.
Oh, well, yeah, there is that.
And we'll also be going into our bizarre treasure for this week, a movie where we pick every week that's from the vaults of Cinema de Bizarre. And this week we're looking at Raiders of Atlantis, Ruggero Deodato.
Yes, he of Cannibal Holocaust and Jungle Holocaust and House on the Edge of the Park, coming in and doing a little action for us.
Yep, and it is off the wall.
It is. It's the only other movie that I know that has both Raiders and a crystal skull in it, yet has nothing to do with Indiana Jones.
Why don't we just dive right into the news here, Bug?
We got a little news we want to share with you people. We delved around the internet to find the most interesting things we could bring and share with you folks tonight. So, first up, William Friedkin. He's always one opinionated guy, usually talking about his high opinion of himself.
Yeah.
This week, he has come out and said that there is just no way in the world that The Exorcist will ever be converted to 3D.
Darn.
I know. That's what we were all looking for. He actually said specifically, no, never. Providing I'm still alive, Warner Brothers is obligated to come to me, and they do. The point is, it's a totally different medium. Of course, as we know, a different medium won't help you. You've got to have a young priest and an old priest.
Right.
Hey, that's just how it is. So, I got to agree with him, though. It's not a movie that should be made in 3D. I'm not happy with this whole, let's convert everything into 3D.
Well, you mean you don't want pea suit vomit shooting at your face in 3D?
Oddly enough, I don't. It's not actually that it's the pea suit vomit as much as, I mean, that movie wasn't intended to be 3D. I know they're talking about putting out Star Wars in 3D and a lot of other older movies and converting them through this 3D process. I know James Cameron's actually came out and said people need to chill because, like, that's not really going to work. I know they've gone back and converted the new Clash of the Titans film that's coming out. They're making that 3D now.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, apparently it's the craze. So they have to.
Well, yeah, I don't really want to see a huge Linda Blair stabbing herself in the vagina and screaming, "Let Jesus fuck you," in 3D.
No, it's not really necessary. Freak went on to say that films like Citizen Kane and Gone with the Wind would not benefit from 3D. No shit. I mean, do we need Casablanca in 3D? You know, probably not. You know, it's kind of pretty obvious. But one thing that William Friedkin does like is Blu-ray.
Uh-huh.
He was promoting the Blu-ray remastering of The Exorcist, and he was quoted as saying that Blu-ray is the real cinematheque of world cinema.
Hmm.
I don't really know what that means, but all right. I've yet to get a Blu-ray myself, so I have no idea. Do you have one?
I've not jumped on the Blu-ray bandwagon just yet.
Yeah, I'm not quite convinced yet, and I got a big fancy TV and everything, but it just can't quite make that hurdle.
I think mainly my thing is I'm not really a techie guy when it comes to movies and stuff. I mean, it's great when they remaster things and it all comes out really nice and crisp and clean. That's all great, but it's not something that's like, that's what I have to have. Because I'll still watch the, poppy and scratchy shit from the 70s and it doesn't bug me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, take for example, we watched Raiders of Atlantis this week. You know, if I'm watching that on one of those Blu-rays that, like, ups your DVD or whatever, really, is Raiders of Atlantis really going to benefit from that? I just don't feel like it.
I think it would hinder it.
Yeah, more than likely. More than likely, it would spit it back out and be like, I don't know what this is that you put in me, but I reject it.
The Godzilla-like miniatures in Blu-ray, I don't think would.
No, probably not. Probably not. Of course, Friedkin was not done, though. He had more to say.
He said cruising will not be in 3D, right?
Yes, he did say that cruising will not be in 3D and wouldn't benefit from 3D.
At that time,
I'm not sure. But he went on to talk smack a little bit about the Exorcist sequels.
Wow.
I thought this quote was pretty interesting, so I want to share this with the folks. He said, all of the sequels suck. All of the fucking sequels of it. I wouldn't piss on them if they were on fire. They are all shit. One of the reasons is because the people that make them have no belief in the original story. It was about shtick and putting their own imprinter on it rather than belief in the story or the understanding of what the story was about. Well, I agree that the second one is really bad. And that's from John Borman, who's normally pretty solid. But the third one is a really good movie, and I think that comes from coming from Blatty, who of course wrote it and who knows best what the story is about, I think.
Yeah, you'd think. Yeah, three, I dig three. I don't know if any of them compare to the first one, but do they have to?
No, I mean, you know, there are the rare sequel, you know, The Godfather 2, The Empire Strikes Back,
sure,
that people do like better than the original. But it's few and far between. But, you know, I think that sometimes sequels do have things to offer. You know, I covered a lot of sequels back on Halloween, and one of the ones I covered was The Exorcist 3, and I was really surprised to see how many people out there really do like that film.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
But that's about it for Mr. Friedkin. As usual, you know, Friedkin talking about what he can talk about the best. Friedkin. So we'll move on to our second story tonight, and it appears that the Frankenstein monster is going to make its way back to the big screen again. But maybe not the Frankenstein monster that we all really know. It appears that 1019 Entertainment, which is the producers of the Fantastic Four films, which that in and of itself is kind of troublesome.
Oh boy.
They've acquired the rights to bring Dean Koontz's Frankenstein books to the screen. Now, I read the books a little while back. I think I read the first two or three. I think I got to the third one. And they're not bad pulpy beach reads. They're not just written by Koontz. They're written by Koontz and somebody else. Of course, from what I understand reading around on the internet, the somebody else ghostwriter names have been taken off the current pressings of them, which I thought was a little interesting.
Yeah, it's not a good sign.
No, but I mean, you know, it's the same. I mean, Koontz has always been kind of B-level compared to, like, Stephen King or Clive Barker or somebody like that, but I think he writes an entertaining book, and his Frankenstein stories are set in modern day. They have to do with the Frankenstein monster going to New Orleans on the trail of maybe Victor Frankenstein, who's also still alive, through some means, and there's a serial killer tied up in it and whatnot. A few years back, they made this into a USA original film, which in and of itself is not, you know, a good notion either. with Parker Posey and Adam Goldberg as the cops on the trail of the Frankenstein monster, which was very odd casting.
Yeah, I vaguely remember this, but I do remember it, though.
Yeah, it was, I mean, it was not terrible, but it wasn't great either. They had planned to kind of spin it off into a series, and that didn't happen at all. So, you know, maybe it is time for Frankenstein to come back to the screen and be a little different. I mean, vampires have been a little different. We got, you know, the werewolf out there being a little different. So maybe it's time Frankenstein gets a little thing. But who knows?
Well, I'm not totally against it. But I don't know. Putting Frankenstein in a modern setting to me just kind of, I don't know, it takes a little bit out of it for me. Because it almost seems like a lot of reason why Frankenstein works is because of the time period that it took place in.
Right, I agree, but, I mean, they have failed before trying to bring that story back, specifically.
Well, yeah, that's true.
I mean, the that Robert De Niro version of Frankenstein was not good. And then if you reach back a little further, I mean, they tried Bride of Frankenstein with Sting in the movie The Bride.
Yeah.
And that was... Whew, that was bad.
There's most Frankenstein movies from the past, what, 20, 30 years have been pretty horrible.
Yeah, they definitely are. So, I mean, this is one that I don't have high hopes on it. The source material is not exactly the best thing in the world, but it'll probably be set in New Orleans, and I'm a whore for that kind of thing, so I will probably see it.
See, if they're going to start bringing back Universal Monsters, because, you know, with the Wolfman and Frankenstein and vampires and all that... The creature, man. The creature from the Black Lagoon. That's the one that needs to be brought back and give a modern spin on with all our special effects now.
I think that's actually happening.
Is it?
I'm looking it up now, but I believe it is. I believe it's scheduled, yes, for 2011.
Oh, nice. I had not heard about that.
Yes, there's no casting. There's no anything. There's a director attached. His name is Carl Winsk. And he's apparently directed fuck all that I've ever heard of.
I was like, fuck all. What, yes. Have I seen that?
No, I don't. I've never seen fuck all at all. I've seen a lot of shit. Never seen fuck all. It definitely appears they are planning a remake of that, especially probably Wolfman. It seems to be doing pretty good, so we'll have to wait and see what happens with that.
Okay, what else you got?
Well, let's see. Let me see how this makes you feel inside. So, Lars von Trier.
Boo!
He's fun. I recently watched Antichrist, and that is just a feel-good film of the year.
That's what I hear.
He's always out to kind of, like, stir the pot. And a few years back, he challenged a friend of his, Jordan Loth, to remake a film, The Perfect Human. But he gave him a set of obstacles. They had to be all in Cuba, or it had to be animated, or different things like that. And the result, Loth came out with a film called The Five Obstacles, and 10 people appeared to like that. I've never seen it myself, but I'm kind of interested in it. But rumor has it, and it's been denied by von Trier and the other parties involved, but, you know, that... It's still fun to talk about anyway. The rumor has it that von Trier wants to challenge Martin Scorsese to a similar kind of thing with the film Taxi Driver.
Yay.
Yeah.
That sounds like a great idea.
Oh, yeah. What they should totally do is go out and remake Taxi Driver, because that will not make anybody mad at all. Take it for what it is, but, you know, like I said, all the parties involved have said one way or another. And, von Trier, who knows what he's doing? He's apparently in production of another movie called Planet Melancholia. It's going to be like some kind of sci-fi movie about a planet that's hovering too close to the Earth.
One thing you got to give up for that guy is it definitely the outlines of his movies always sound intriguing.
Mm-hmm. They do. When I first heard about Antichrist, I read the synopsis and went like, oh, well, that's something I definitely want to see. And then after watching Antichrist, I was kind of like, I'm pretty pissed. And I wasn't actually sure if I was pissed at the movie or pissed at von Trier or pissed because of what was in the movie, or I was unsure. So, you know, I guess... In the end, he provokes a response.
I've yet to check it out myself, but I'm sure I'll get around to seeing it at some point. It's just one of those things. I know I got to be in the right kind of mood to watch something like that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it fits in that kind of mold of movies like, you know, Solo and things like that, where, like, you're just not going to sit down and watch them for fun.
It's a lot of what people said about the movie Funny Games.
Yeah, I've seen the original. I've not seen that remake one with the same director, though.
Yeah, I haven't seen the remake either, but I actually did like the first one, but it's the kind of movie it's like, yeah, either you hate it with every fiber of your being, or you like it kind of.
Right. Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, that's That movie I did like, but it definitely was a very mean-spirited film overall.
Oh yeah, definitely. There's a hollowness and coldness of that film that I'm not saying that to knock it, but it's just that is what it is, kind of a thing. So
right. So let's see, one final story I have, and this is kind of a weird one. I've not heard anything about this movie at all until this week when I was digging around for stuff. There's a movie on the horizon that's being made called Passion Play. It's being billed as a romantic thriller and directed by Mitch Glazer. He's usually a writer. He wrote Scrooged. And The Recruit, which was a fairly good movie, and Great Expectations, apparently, which, it was the best of times, it was the worst of movies. But apparently he's got this film now, and the synopsis says it's a period story that tells of a down-on-his-luck jazz trumpet player who forms a bond with a winged beauty who's now part of a sideshow attraction at a carnival. That in and of itself would pique my interest. Then when you find out the trumpet player is Mickey Rourke, and the winged beauty is Megan Fox, it kind of makes for a very interesting mix that piques my interest. Not a huge Megan Fox fan, but it just sounds so bizarre.
Oh, you gotta add the other cast member in there.
Oh, yes, I almost forgot. Playing a mobster who's trying to keep the two of them apart. And when you're looking for somebody to play a mobster, this is your first go-to guy. Bill Murray.
Now, he did play a gangster. Was it Mad Dog and Glory?
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that one. He did. That's right, he has played a gangster before.
To not very, very good effect.
No, not at all. But it sounds like an interesting little thing. It's being shopped around, I guess, and it's actually in production. I've seen a few pictures from it, and it looks very bizarre. It kind of maybe could be kind of like maybe an Angel Heart type of thing. It seems like, you know.
Does it come across as something like dark? Because I'm seeing it could go either way. It could be something really dark, but an arc could also be something kind of light and stupid.
You know, it's really hard to say. All I've really seen is the synopsis and a couple of pictures. You know, my hope is that it would be a little dark and a little, you know, maybe mystical or something like that. I've seen some things that perhaps she's a fallen angel or something like that, so I guess we'll have to wait and see on that one, but it sure sounds like an interesting little thing.
It definitely sounds interesting. It's just, I'm sure it's one of those 50-50 things. It's either going to be interesting and entertaining, or it's going to be just awful crap.
Right. It'll either be one or the other, but it probably won't be anything in between at all.
No, at all, no.
And people will give it a hard time to begin with when it comes out, just because it has Megan Fox in it.
I really can't knock her because I've never seen anything that she's been in. So, but I've not heard very many positive things about her. But
I saw the first Transformers. It was terrible, of course, and she was bad in it. And then I saw Jennifer's Body, and I did not hate that film as a lot of people did, and I really liked her in it because she played exactly what she should play. She was kind of the, you know, aloof, unattainable, you know, beauty or whatever, even though I don't consider her much of a beauty myself.
Vapid bitch?
Yeah, same thing.
That's the way she comes across in real life, so.
Right, and, you know, and she's got this crazy, nasty thumbs. Have you ever checked that out? Her thumbs are freaking just, oh, so gross. Check out her thumbs, man, I'm telling you. That's something I heard about that on another podcast on... And I thought, well, no, I mean, her thumbs can't be that bad. And I looked it up, and oh my god, it was just nasty.
She's got, like, big toe thumbs, or what?
Yeah, something like that. They're all just, like, malformed and just look weird. I don't know if maybe she was going to come out with a flipper at one time or something. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not really that blown away by her. I mean, I'm not going to say I'm not going to say she's ugly or anything, but she's definitely not my type.
No, not mine. Not mine at all. I like my women more from the 70s.
I wouldn't kick her out of bed, though, I guess is what I'm saying.
I would probably kick her out of bed because I would be like, get those nasty thumbs away from her.
Okay, I haven't seen her thumbs yet, so I guess I can't really.
Check out those thumbs. You may reconsider your opinion. But I guess that's about it for the old news roundup this week. So we will say goodbye to you folks for just a moment. We've got a message here from B through Z Webzine. That's a great site. I've done some writing for him myself. Reverend Phantom writes for him pretty regularly. So you're going to check that out. And then we're going to come back and we're going to check out Sugar Hill. So join us back here for that.
Hello, freaks. Reverend Phantom here, and I want to tell you about one of the best horror and exploitation websites around.
B-Through-Z.com.
B-Through-Z features interviews with the genre stars that you love and tons of great reviews and articles written by people with a passion, if not a sick love, for horror, exploitation, and B-movies in general. B-Through-Z.com is more than a website. It's a horror fanzine that releases a new online issue every month. It's just like a horror magazine that you'd pick up at a store, but it's only available online, and best of all, it's free. In this day and age, with the economy as shitty as it is, who can appreciate that? If you haven't checked out B-Through-Z.com yet, what the hell are you waiting for? Get thee to B-Through-Z and see what all the buzz is about, and tell them that TL Bug and the Reverend sent ya. Later, freaks.
Blood is red. Voodoo is blue. Sugar is sweet. Revenge is sweeter. Meet Sugar Hill. Not a place, but a brand new face. The foxiest, sexiest, deadliest chicken town. The mob took Sugar's man away, and now she's gonna make them pay.
I want them dead.
With a voodoo priestess called Mama Matres, and Baron Samedi too, and an army of undead behind her. There's nothing that Sugar can't do. The mob has never seen anything like Sugar Hill and her zombie hitmen. Sugar Hill from American International, rated PG, parental guidance suggested.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, and we're going to be talking a little Sugar Hill from 1974.
Yeah.
Yeah, directed by Paul Mulaski. This is the only film he ever directed. He went on to produce the Police Academy films of all weird things.
Woohoo!
Starring Marky Bay, Robert Corey, Don Pedro Colley, Betty Ann Reese, and Richard Lawson. Synopsis of Sugar Hill is, when the mob kills her boyfriend because he won't pay protection money, Diana Sugar Hill begins to seek a means for revenge. She seeks the help of Mama Matrice, a voodoo priestess, who leads her to a meeting with Baron Samedi. The Baron dispatches a group of zombies to do Sugar's bidding, and they begin to kill off all the mob boss's men. As the zombies hack and tear through her enemies, police officer Valentine begins to suspect the killings are related to a voodoo and starts closing in on Sugar Hill. So this is it's a pretty interesting film. I liked it pretty well.
Yeah, this is a good one. There's not a whole lot of blaxploitation horror movies that I can say that I'm really crazy about. There's a few good ones, and this is definitely one of the good ones.
Yeah, I mean, you know, most of the other ones you can trace, like, just put a direct line between Dracula and Blackula.
Right.
Frankenstein and...
Blackenstein,
yes. They were very clever with the names. Even Abby and The Exorcist. And there's a direct line between the two. This movie and, like, JD's Revenge, they have less of a direct line linking them to something.
Right.
This, I mean, maybe, you know, something like I Walked with a Zombie or White Zombie or something like that might have influenced this script. But, you know, it's a definitely an original type of film.
Oh, yeah. And as far as, you know, zombie movies go, yeah, the look of the zombies in this film are pretty unique. The I Walked with a Zombie kind of is probably the closest thing to compare to as far as the look of the zombies in this film.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, these are definitely voodoo zombies. There's no mistake. These are not Romero zombies.
And it's something about the eyes. It's like they got these big silver bulging eyes, but in the dark, it just looks like they got these little tiny white pupils. So it's really effective.
I agree, but when I first saw those silver contact things that they were making those people wear, all I could think about is 1974. How bad would those have hurt?
Oh, I know. Yeah, they had
that's hazard pay involved with that. But they did look really cool. Although, you know, maybe border on a little cheesy with, like, all the Halloween cowboy.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. There's
hanging on zombies.
There's some serious campiness going on in this film that you've got to expect going into it.
Yeah, there is, but you know, it kind of pulls it out from having a pretty good cast.
Yeah.
Marky Bay was not in a whole lot of stuff. She was in. She made her debut in Hal Ashby's The Landlord.
Yeah.
And then she did a pretty long run on Starsky and Hutch. I think it said 12 or 13 episodes, but she didn't appear in a whole lot of stuff. And I think it's because she didn't really fit the kind of norm of the blaxploitation heroine. She didn't kind of fit that mold of, like, that Pam Grier had set out.
No, but she holds up pretty well in this show. I'm actually surprised that she didn't get some, at least a few more quality roles after it, which she just kind of stuck to little television roles afterwards.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, she was pretty good. She could definitely rock a white and red jumpsuit. I really loved it that she'd have normal clothes, but when she was going with the zombies to kill people, she had to put on that jumpsuit. Like, that was her killing mobsters outfit.
Yeah, there was something very cartoonish about that. It just seemed like something you'd see out of, like, a Hanna-Barbera cartoon or something.
Yeah, it definitely was. Mobster is played by Robert Corey, who I really love. I know from Count Yorga is one of his big starring roles, but I really love him from the Vincent Price movie Madhouse.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Great flick.
Yeah, and he's very solid here. He definitely knew what kind of material he was involved in and was not scared to go over the top at all.
Who I really liked was Charles Robinson, Mac from Night Court.
Oh, is that who that was? It was driving me crazy.
Yep. He was also in The Black Gestapo as well, which is a horrible flick. But yeah, he was in this and being a badass.
I had not realized that was him. His name was Fabulous.
Fabulous.
And I really loved his kind of array of crushed velvet outfits. He was also in a movie called Grey Lady Down, which is one that I like. It's a submarine movie with Stacy Keach in one of his rare no-toupee Stacy Keach roles. Where you get the full bald roles. Probably my favorite person, though, was Don Pedro Colley as Baron Samedi.
Oh, yeah, he pretty much steals the movie, even from Bay, because Bay's really great to look at, but yeah, I was almost like, I want my Baron Zemaldi movie follow-up.
Oh, no doubt. He was so good in it. And it drove me crazy the whole time what I had seen him in, because I knew he seemed familiar for some reason. And then I looked it up. He was Sheriff Little on the Dukes of Hazzard.
Oh, okay.
The occasional African American sheriff that would come through Hazzard County.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I was like, oh, that has to be it. So it was great to see him in this. He was really, really good.
Yeah, great look, just great presence. He's great in this.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a whole lot of Baron Samedi's on film. The only one I can really call off the top of my head would be the one from Live and Let Die, which isn't really the same. But this one, I mean, he was exactly what I wanted that character to be.
Actually, I just saw, what's the new Disney movie? The Princess and the Frog with my daughter.
Oh, yeah?
And it actually, this movie reminded me of it a lot. They seemed like they were drawing a little bit from, obviously this whole thing comes from, you know, the actual voodoo legends and stuff like that. Right. But there was the look of the main villain. Mm-hmm. The fact that he brings these like voodoo, it's they're more like ghosts in right. in the Disney film, but not mm-hmm. zombies, but it was kind of like the same kind of deal. So yeah.
Right. Another one of my favorite characters was Celeste, Morgan's girlfriend, the mobster's girl. Cause she was bringing the racism hard. I mean, she was definitely in there to be the terribly racist white person that you just had to hate.
Yeah, and it's usually not the female in those movies. Yeah, that was real.
That was kind of interesting because Robert Corey as Morgan, he was more like interested in Marky Bay, like, hey, she's hot.
Right.
So it was kind of interesting to have the female character be like that. And I really enjoyed their cat fight.
Yeah, that was a good one. It didn't quite top the cat's fight in Coffee, but yeah, it's definitely up there, though.
No, I mean, there was nobody ripped anybody else's clothes off or anything like that.
Which brings to mind that this film is pretty tame.
It really is. I mean, honestly, this would be, if it was rated maybe PG-13, maybe PG.
It would definitely be, definitely would not be R. Because, I mean, even the gore is pretty tame.
Yeah, I mean, really, you get a little blood, you get, no nudity at all, which was a little disappointing. But there's not like a whole ton of violence or anything in it. I mean, most of the, you know, the zombies will get somebody and then it'll kind of cut away and you'll get a reveal of what happened to them later.
Right.
But I mean, generally I enjoyed it, but I mean, I kind of wish it had taken that extra step to be just a little more graphic.
Yeah, it definitely could have went that extra step. I'm not sure why it didn't. It was, who produced it? Zarkov produced it, who produced a majority of the great blaxploitation movies from the 70s. So,
right.
I don't know what market they were actually going for there. I guess it was, maybe they were aiming for a younger crowd. I don't know. The 70s were weird.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't know exactly who they were making this film for, but I know in the end they were making this film for me. Because this is one that I'm probably going to go back to several times, and I can't wait to show it to other people and tell people about it. It's one I've been hearing about for a long time.
Something I was going to run past you that I really didn't notice it on, I guess I didn't really think about it on previous viewings of the film, but when the zombies come out of their graves, now this film came out in 74, I don't remember very many zombie movies prior to that you saw them actually crawling out of the dirt.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I don't think that was done much. I mean, and by that time Romero had only made Night. I mean, even in the later ones, it's not, you get a whole lot of grave popping.
I mean, and in that you didn't see anything crawling out. Any of the old zombie movies, you never saw anybody crawling out. And my memory might not serve me well, but And I believe, what was the Let Sleeping Corpses Lie or whatever.
Right.
I know I believe that came out the same year, and I don't think there were any zombies crawling out of graves in that one either.
Not that I recall. I think they just showed up.
No, and I'm bringing this up because obviously after this, that was something mm-hmm. that would, you know, you saw quite a bit in Fulci's Zombie mm-hmm. and the Michael Jackson's Thriller, Return mm-hmm. of the Living Dead. So quite an influential scene.
Yeah, that's very interesting to note. It's not something that crossed my mind, but definitely something that, now that I think about it, I mean, you're right, hadn't been done a whole lot, and then afterwards it was done to death.
Right.
The only other thing I've really got here is a rating, I think. That's all I've got. You got anything else?
Nope. I think we covered everything I've jotted down here.
All right. That's all of my notes as well. So it's time to put a rating on this one. If you don't recall, I'll refresh everybody. We have three levels of rating around here at Sinful Cinema. The top rating is Cinematic Heaven, and those are movies you should definitely go check out. The middle rating is The Purgatory of Lost Films. Those are films that are great to watch on TV or rent or something like that, but probably not something you want to add to your collection. And, you know, the last rating, which we'll rarely, probably, hopefully, rarely use, is Damnation. And those are movies you just probably want to avoid. So, for this one, Rev, what do you think?
Well, seeing as though this is a film that's, I believe, still not available officially on DVD, so it's been in purgatory for a long time, so I'm just going to go ahead and just send it to Cinematic Heaven.
You know, I've got to agree with you. Like I said, this is one that I can't wait to share with my friends, that I really think that I'm really glad I finally got it. And hopefully, you know, somebody, I have no idea why there are so many, you know, the blaxploitation titles have really come out on DVD, why this one has been stuck in purgatory for so long. I don't know. It definitely gets a cinematic heaven from me, too.
Yeah, Sugar Hill needs to walk into the light.
It does, indeed. So that's our review of the blaxploitation zombie classic, Sugar Hill. Now we're going to give you a little bit of the trailer from Runaways, featuring Tom Selleck and Gene Simmons.
What do you got, Jerry?
Model 912 cut up two people inside the house.
I'm going in.
You're going in? We can send a disarm robot in.
It'll hit the floater, it'll hit the disarm, and any minute it's going to decide to hit the kid.
An ingenious conspiracy has begun, and someone has to stop the madman who started it all.
We've got a non-standard chip here. Turn any domestic computer into a killing machine.
Working late at night all by yourself?
I just had a few things to finish up.
No,
no big deal.
I insist. Let me help you.
No.
Bug detected.
Got a lot of bugs, Jackie. I thought I was clean.
Luther really wants to keep track of you. Why's that, Jackie?
This is a bad guy.
He's killed five so far. I want him.
I'm telling you, I can't go out there. I can't go out!
To get through to you. He sees everything. He knows everything that's going on in here.
You can't run away, Ramsey. My little machines will find you wherever you go.
You've heard of a bullet that has your name on it? This isn't a runaway. This is murder.
We're never going to make it through this one.
Runaway, Tom Selleck, Cynthia Rhodes, Gene Simmons, Runaway.
All right, and we are back, and we are taking a look at Runaway from 1984 with, as we mentioned, Tom Selleck. Now, I don't know about you, Bug, but I think I'm seeing a trend here. I think it's been Blaxploitation Month over at my site, but I think here at Sinful Cinema it's been Facial Hair Month.
We do seem to like a lot of facial hair around here, but I think that's just something that runs through genre film, a lot of facial hair.
Just a coincidence.
Yeah, there's nothing sinister involved, we swear.
All right, Runaway. In the near future, which happens to look a lot like the 80s, a police officer specializes in malfunctioning robots. When a robot turns out to have been programmed to kill, he begins to uncover a homicidal plot to create killer robots, and his son becomes a target.
I believe, if I remember right, at the beginning of the film, they said the future was 1994. Far-flung year of 1994.
Which looks a lot like 1984, but with robots.
Yes, that's right. This film was directed and written by Michael Crichton.
Mm-hmm.
which everybody knows from Jurassic Park and all that. But he did direct a few films other than this, too.
Yeah, he's probably better known for a writer. But, yeah, he did Westworld. Yeah.
Westworld, the first train robbery with, I think that has Sean Connery in it. That's a pretty good movie.
Mm-hmm.
And this definitely feels like a Crichton story to me.
Oh, yeah. It's what I give him a lot of credit for in his films. This one and some of his others is he really is he's good at creating tension.
Yeah.
And he really does it here.
Yeah, he does. And I think he's also good at making kind of the illogical and plausible work. I mean, the robots in this are not like androids. They're like these boxy, kind of unwieldy looking things. They're very... it seems like something that could be.
Right, exactly. Which brings up the question is, where the hell is my robot made?
You know, I would
it's 2010!
I know. I would like to know where that is. We're like 16 years beyond where we should have had those. And yet I still don't have a robot made to take my phone calls and remind my non-existent son to go to bed.
Exactly, and make dinner and all that great shit.
Right. You know, I thought, you know, Selleck, I really kind of enjoyed him in this role, even though I call him a natural actor, because if you put him in Magnum P.I. or this or Quigley Down Under, it doesn't really matter. He's right. Tom Selleck.
Exactly.
But I think he has a real charisma to him. I was really, you know, he has kind of like a folksy kind of way about him almost that really kind of made the character appeal to me.
Well, he was the Marlboro man, right?
Well, yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, so there is something about him. I don't know if I can necessarily place it as well as you have there, because the whole thing I'm watching, I'm going, what is the appeal of Tom Selleck? Because I thought he was doing a great job, but I mean, if you remember back in the 80s, I mean, mostly women, but I mean, people like love that guy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's true. And I mean, I will admit, I was a pretty big Magnum PI fan back in the day. I was no Fall Guy, but, you know,
no.
You know, I mean, Magnum PI is pretty good. but, you know, he was pretty good at it. This has a pretty interesting cast of people in it, too. Because you've got his partner, Officer Cynthia Rhodes, is played by Karen Thompson. Or, excuse me, I got that backwards. Excuse me, Karen Thompson's right. Played by Cynthia Rhodes. I'm sorry, I'm having a dyslexic moment. And that's that was Penny from Dirty Dancing, the girl who got the back alley abortion.
She was also in Staying Alive and Flashdance, so I give her a lot of credit for doing a movie where there was no dancing involved.
Oh, well, she was in everything with dancing. I did not realize that, but it was driving me and my wife crazy watching this, and she looked up, she was like, oh my god, it's Penny. And so the rest of, you know, the movie, we were pretty much, you know, like, no, Penny, don't get that back alley abortion. Don't do it. This also stars, as we mentioned earlier, Gene Simmons.
Yeah. Now, this is what actually drew me to the movie when I was a kid, because I saw this when this first came out, and it was one of those movies that was always on cable, and I had to watch it every time because I'm a huge Kiss fan. It was like, so Gene Simmons plays the bad guy. So it was, right. And I haven't seen it in years. I probably haven't seen it since I was a preteen, and so I was kind of like, I wonder if this is still as good as I remember it was. And I have to say, as far as the movie, it was pretty entertaining, and I think Gene Simmons does a pretty decent job here.
You know, he does. Not too long back, my wife and our friend Fran reviewed Never Too Young to Die for The Lair.
Yep, I remember
and,
that.
And Simmons was in that, too, playing a transvestite baddie.
And he's way over the top in that one.
Way over the top. So it was kind of interesting to see him in this one. I'm kind of more just a menacing type of performance. Yeah, I've actually got a little quote here that I found from Gene Simmons' biography about this role. He said that Crichton asked him to stare at him for about a minute without making any facial expressions. Apparently, Crichton decided that Simmons looked menacing enough and cast him in the role of Charlie Luther.
So I believe it.
Kind of interesting that he got the role from just looking mean.
Well, Well, yeah, I mean, most of his scenes in the film, it's like, yeah, he's just got that menacing stare. He doesn't even have to say anything, and he really doesn't have a whole lot of dialogue,
not a ton, but he does have a heat-seeking rocket gun, which was absolutely one of my favorite things about the movie, the whole bullet and the, you know, locking on target with a heat-seeking bullet. That was just, I really enjoyed that. I'm surprised that hasn't ever come up again in another film.
No, that was, but, you know, it's funny that they called it a smart bullet, which, you know, we've got smart bombs now, so it's a little bit of fiction becoming true here.
A little bit, yeah.
Still no robot maids, though.
No, still no robot maids. We got smart bombs, but we have no smart maids. Well, I mean, maybe real ones, I don't know.
Doesn't that say it all?
Yeah, probably. Also, a couple other people I wanted to mention that appeared in this. Kirstie Alley appears in it for not very long, but she is in it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a pre-Cheers, post-Wrath of Khan Kirstie Alley.
Pre-fat Kirstie Alley.
Well, I wouldn't go there, but I mean, it's true. You know, spade a spade. But she's looking pretty good in this movie. I really used to like Kirstie Alley a lot in the 80s.
Yeah.
And she was one of my bigger crushes when she was on Cheers, and she was looking pretty good here, even though she was not in the movie very much.
I have to say, this film brought back a childhood trauma that I had long forgotten. They came back in a flashback as I was watching.
Oh, yeah?
Well, I don't even know if I should say it because it's kind of a spoiler, but something happens to Kirstie Alley in the film. Mm-hmm. I won't say what, but it's a traumatic thing, and Kirstie Alley actually looks a lot like my older sister.
Mm.
And I remember watching that film crying when that part, because she looks so much like my sister.
Oh, that's funny.
Like, I totally forgot about that. Then it came back like in this big, like traumatic, like flashback. I was like,
oh no. That is funny. There's another actor in here, and he provides the link that runs between this film and Sugar Hill, interestingly enough. And that's G.W. Bailey. He shows up as the chief of police here, but he's probably best known as Captain Harris in Police Academy.
Oh, yeah.
So there's kind of a little interesting link between our first two films tonight. And he's not in the film much either, but again, I really enjoyed it anytime he showed up, mostly because it was like, hey, it's Captain Harris.
You're right. Yeah, either Police Academy or Mannequin are the two movies I really relate him to.
All right, I think I forgot he was in Mannequin. I haven't seen that in a long time.
Switcher, you're one sick puppy.
I mean, overall, I thought everything from the acting to the directing to kind of the natural type of feel to the robots and everything, it made for a pretty interesting film. And this is one, before you brought it up for the show, I had seen it on Netflix Instant Watch and kind of browsed over it because I saw Tom Selleck. And I was like, well, you know, it's probably not any good. And I was really pleasantly surprised to find out how good it really was.
Yeah, that's what really got me too, because given the sub, anytime you get into the sci-fi movies that we've already gone past the date that it's supposed to take place.
Oh yeah, well that's always good.
You're taking a chance with it being pretty cheesy, so, which, you know, like I mentioned, how the future still looks like the 80s, and it's funny how like people in the 80s, like Windows was for computers was totally. Yeah, they did not envision. It's like we were going to have a DOS system forever.
Oh, forever and ever. That is all we would ever have is DOS. Right. Although I did like a few of the things they had in the movie, the technological wonders. I liked it when they brought up his mugshot and it like looked around and like winked at people.
Oh yeah, the sketch artist basically, she was just putting together pieces of the face and everything. That was pretty tight.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting. I was like, oh, hey, it came to life, and now it's going to wink at you. That's strange. I don't know why they would have programmed it to do that, but alrighty. So there were a couple little technological things in it that were kind of cool, even though they're a little cheesy.
Oh, I mean, and I'm not going to give up on the maid thing. That was so freaking cool, dude. I'm sitting there going, God damn it, I want that. It's like,
I know she answers your phone calls, she cooks your dinner, she parents your child. I mean, it was pretty much a maid that would do anything. And it appeared she was also made out of spare parts from jam boxes. So she could probably, you know, serve as a ghetto blaster if need be.
Right. And if, for people who have not seen it, this is basic. It's basically the maid from the Jetsons, basically in a completely different form.
Yeah, it's definitely it's a little like Rosie.
Right. That's the name.
But more just like a square black thing with like lights on it.
And in the one arm. It's like, it does all this shit with one arm?
I know, that's amazing. But it appeared all the robots had one arm.
Right.
It didn't appear like they had solved the problem of two-armed robots yet.
Yeah.
And maybe with all the killer robots, that's for the best.
Right. Yeah, that's another thing. It's like, there were a whole police force designed to just go after robots that are on the fritz.
Right, I thought that was pretty interesting. The only thing that didn't really work was they tried to work in this whole plot about Selleck's character having vertigo.
Yeah.
And it seemed really just like forced in, and it came back up later in the climax of the film, but it was kind of like he sure got over it real fast.
Right.
And it just really didn't add anything, and I'm not exactly sure why it was there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ending, I mean, it was all for the ending, which,
right,
like you said, he gets over it pretty quick, but I guess, I mean, anybody in that situation probably would, I guess, to some extent. Yeah. I guess
James Stewart's character in Vertigo actually does get over his fear a little too quickly, too.
Yeah.
In the end of the film. So I suppose it's not all that absurd in movie world. But it just felt shoehorned in there unnecessarily. Like, it would come up every once in a while, but there was no reason for it, really, except for the ending.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't needed. It could have done it without it, yeah.
Right. The only person who was terrible in the movie, and I forgot to write down his name or anything, but whoever played the kid, Tom Selleck's kid, was just horrible. That kid was, I mean, it was some of the worst child acting I've ever seen.
That kid was in, did you ever see Flight of the Navigator?
Oh, I did. Yeah, is that the kid from that movie?
That's the kid from that movie.
Wow, he was much better in that movie. Because he was just absolutely horrible. I mean, he only really has three or four scenes, but every one of them he's in is just like, it was painful.
You know, and I have a little theory with kid actors. It seems that kid actors really need a great director.
Right.
So if the director, or at least a director that can, you know, speak to kids,
right,
in a way that, you know, that they can understand, and obviously,
I'm not seeing Michael Crichton being that guy anyway.
You know, speaking of, you know, our last podcast with Ink, obviously, mm-hmm. I'm spacing on the director's name now, but he had a way of really working well with a child.
Yeah, that's definitely true, but. Yeah, not so much for Mr. Crichton. Luckily, the kid was a very, very small part of the movie.
Yes.
But every time he showed up, it would just drag everything so far down. He really bothered me.
And I think a little bit, to speak on the kid's behalf, his part really wasn't written very well. The dialogue was kind of painful.
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, those scenes seem like, you know, Crichton's not really known for his dialogue anyway.
I mean, the kid seemed like 10 or 11, but he was talking like a 5-year-old.
Yeah, I know. You'd think the robot maid would have taught him better. Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, the robot maid had some trouble with her talking, too. But later on in the film, when there's a traumatic incident with the robot maid, that was probably one of my favorite scenes.
Yeah.
Because it was just so bizarre.
Yeah.
But we just can't give it up on this robot maid. It definitely was something that stood out for me in the film overall, too.
Definitely. Well, I'm thinking we enjoyed this one.
I did, but I'm not sure this is one people really need to add to their collection or rush out to see.
No, especially because it's not. I don't know. It's you definitely got to be into one sci-fi movies from the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
RoboCop, mm-hmm. Predator. If you dig those kind of films, I'd say that this would probably appeal to you. But there's going to be people that this is just not going to be their thing.
Yeah, I mean, some people might like it for Selleck or the robots or whatever. I mean, there are definitely reasons to like this film, and it is enjoyable to watch throughout. But I think overall, in the end, I'm going to have to put this one in the purgatory of lost films. I mean, it's definitely one that's out there. It's on Netflix Instant Watch. It's, so if you already have Netflix, it's free to watch it. It's
yep.
decent to watch. But, don't be going like, hey, tomorrow I really have to get on watching Runaway. Because it's, unless you really find this story appealing, then you probably just think it's slightly better than a TV movie.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm gonna place this one in 80s purgatory as well, back where it belongs. And sometimes 80s purgatory is fun to go to. So
yeah, it's not a bad place to go to, and I definitely enjoyed our visit there. So I guess we'll move on to our next film, our bizarre treasure for this week. So Rev, what are we going to be looking at this week?
Yes, we were looking at Ruggiero Deodato's Raiders of Atlantis. We're gonna play a little bit of the De Angelis Brothers' theme song for the movie.
Right. So enjoy these sweet, soothing sounds, and we'll be right back with a review. Yes, we're back after that soothing musical interlude with our bizarre treasure this week. Raiders of Atlantis. As always, our bizarre treasure is a film picked from the vaults of Cinema de Bizarre that you can find at cinema-de-bizarre.com. This is a classic film by Ruggiero Deodato, who most people will know from Cannibal Holocaust fame. He also directed films like Cut and Run and House on the Edge of the Park. Let me give you a little quick synopsis on here. A team of scientists working to raise a submarine from the ocean floor unearth an ancient Atlantic relic from the seafloor, and they bring in an expert to make some sense of it. While they're attempting to raise the sub, though, they accidentally somehow raise Atlantis partially. At the same time, two Vietnam vets, who are now guns for hire, are trying to make their way to an island resort, but they get trapped in the storm that Atlantis caused when it rages, and they are end up drifting out to sea, and they meet up with the scientists, and they find their way to an island where it looks like everybody's been massacred, and they don't know by who, but soon they find out when a vicious group of well-armed raiders and their leader, Crystal Skull, show up, and they turn out to be descendants of Atlantis who are back to reclaim the world and wipe the human beings off the face of the planet. So it ends up being up to Mike and Washington to save the world.
Muhammad.
Oh, yes, Muhammad. I'm sorry. I apologize. I was really hoping you'd do that.
M-U.
Oh, yeah, see, what Rev's referring to there is in the film, Tony King's character, Mike seems to, Mike, the lead character played by Chris Connelly, seems to call him Washington, but apparently Washington has perhaps converted to Islam recently or something like that, and now he wants to be called Muhammad, so every time he gets called Washington for about the first half of the film, he will immediately go, Muhammad!
I like how he, like, pretty much gives up on correcting people, like...
Yeah, I do. I do like that. Like that just disappears. Well, this is a pretty interesting film, but it is not without its problems.
I would say to start out, I'd probably preface this a little bit by saying that it takes a certain kind of B movie fan to find some enjoyment in this film.
That's definitely true. I mean, while Cannibal Holocaust and Jungle Holocaust, and to some extent House on the Edge of the Park, are going to appeal to a wider variety of people, Raiders of Atlantis really, if you don't like really cheesy action, then this is just not going to be for you.
Right. Specifically, if you're into... There was a whole bunch of science fiction, Italian sci-fi movies that came out around this time, after the fall of New York and the New Barbarians, you know, films like that. If you're into these kind of films, I think you'll find something in Raiders of Atlantis. But there's definitely some good things, and there's a lot of bad things. But there are some redeeming qualities to it.
There are definitely. I mean, this is not. Diodato's not known for being like an awesomely stylish filmmaker, but I mean, definitely Cannibal Holocaust, I think, is a very well made film. Some of his other titles, to a lesser degree. But this is really the worst film I've seen from him from a directing standpoint. I mean, it's very. I know the transfer I watched was, you know, it's a little soft, but still, you know, it's just not put together very well.
Yeah, you can tell even though this is a bad transfer and it's got, you know, subtitles from a different language in there, and it's you can still see through the film to know if this was remastered and with all the bells and whistles and everything, it would still be pretty cheesy.
It would. I think part of the problem is the lead, Chris Connelly as Mike. I could never get interested in him at all.
You know, damn, that is my same thought. That's the whole thing I kept thinking of. Is why? Why Christopher Connelly?
I don't know. I mean, he was in the Bronx Warriors. He was not bad in that. He's in Manhattan Baby. He's not bad in that. But for this kind of role, it just... He didn't work out as hero guy.
It's not that he's a bad actor, but it's just this was not the role for him. You needed somebody with charisma because he ends up being the leader, the guy that saves the day, right. And so it needed to be somebody with a lot more screen presence.
Right, and the problem is you had somebody here. Tony King was so good in this movie as Washington slash Muhammad. He was really entertaining. Every word that came out of his mouth was great. I really wanted him to be the main focus of the film. I kept hoping, you know, like, maybe Mike will get killed off. And, you know, Washington can take over this picture. But unfortunately, it never happened.
No, it doesn't. I mean, shit, I mean, even George Hilton probably could have been a better lead.
Yeah, but, I mean, Hilton's in a kind of a strange role for him, I thought, as the, he's a professor. And he's, I mean, he does see some action and whatnot later on in the film, but it was just such kind of a mild-mannered, nerdy type role for George Hilton that I just thought it was very kind of strange.
Right, and I'm a big Ivan Razumov fan. And so yes, I was really glad to see him. The further he got in his career, the smaller his parts got, which is a real shame. But
it does seem that way. I mean, I really liked him in Jungle Holocaust, and he has a small part in Your Vice's Locked Room, or he's very good in that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he was good in this, but his role is just tiny.
Yeah, and seeing him in some other films, he even could have been the lead and did better than Christopher Connelly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Connelly wasn't that interesting, and then I believe her name is Julia Scola,
mm-hmm.
As his love interest, Dr. Kathy Rollins.
Yeah.
Again, like, just a wet blanket. Nothing interesting there, nothing going on with her character that made me, you know, want the two of them to get together or want him to rescue her or anything. I was just kind of like, I was kind of left floating on that one.
Because this, again, I think this is a kind of movie that's just relying on action and that's it. And it does, for, you know, 1983, a low budget Italian film, the stunt work is really good.
Yeah, there is definitely some good stunt work in it, some good firefights. There are some strange moments in the firefights, like when they just find these bottles of liquid and light them on fire and start chucking them, and then they're like, hey, it's napalm! Like, is that not something you should check first?
I know, it's good thing we had some of that lying around.
Yeah, good thing we were just, like, you know, walking around with these bottles full of napalm. But still, yeah, it was pretty good. But one thing I really expected was, as much as they kept showing Crystal Skull, which I believe that's a guy named Bruce Barron, who was in a good bit of martial arts films,
right.
I kept expecting some real payoff with him.
Yeah.
And it never came.
Yeah, it kind of fizzled. But the...
Yeah, it was very strange that just never went anywhere.
It's the whole film's kind of a mess. I mean, even nothing's really explained very thoroughly, and it's mm-hmm. stuff just kind of happens, and I don't know. I watched the whole thing. I felt like I was, you know, fairly entertained. I watched it on Saturday morning, didn't have anything else much more to do, sat there kind of, you know, like, okay, well.
Yeah, I mean, I just finally got around to getting to watch this earlier today, and this was actually my second attempt. I had started watching it while I was doing laundry the other day and got about 30 minutes in and then came home and wanted to do anything else.
Right.
I mean, once I did sit down and watch it, I did enjoy the action. I did enjoy Tony King. I did enjoy seeing, you know, Ivan Razumov and George Hilton and... Michelle Sovai, even in a very small role.
Mm-hmm.
But the sum of the parts really just never added up to much.
And I couldn't help but thinking, I was like watching this whole thing, and even though, I mean, you really could have done anything, you could have done anything with the plot because there's not really much plot to go with, but somewhere lurking under this film, there's a good movie in there somewhere. There's a good idea. I mean, the whole Atlantis rising and mm-hmm. The whole apocalyptic aspect of it. Is, I mean, right. Somewhere in there, if it had just been executed better, obviously with a bigger budget, but I could say that about all those post-apocalyptic Italian movies. If they had a bigger budget, they would have been incredible.
Right. But, you know, there's a good idea, but at the same time, you know, they still had ideas like, the descendants of Atlantis are obviously some kind of mixture of the Bronx Warriors and, you know, 2019 after the fall of New York and the Warriors all kind of mixed up together.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand that at all when they just start showing up and killing people and it's all like crazy punk rock looking people on motorcycles, and that is the Atlantean.
And the question comes up, because this all happens so quick, when did these guys have time to soup up all their vehicles and make all their costumes?
That's a good question. I mean, where did they go to get the spikes put on that old car?
Yeah, maybe they've been preparing for this for months. But again, it's one of those things that just never gets addressed in the film. You just kind of got to go with it.
Yeah, I mean, if you accept the movie for what it is, it's not bad. It's one of those ones you could put on the background. You could invite some people over and you know, sit around and laugh at it or play cards while you're watching it. It's not something you really need to sit down and, like, focus on and go like, oh, I have to give this my undivided attention or I might miss something.
Exactly. And we played a little bit of the score there, which is by the very awesome DeAngelis Brothers, who in the 70s they did, you know, they were just incredible. But once it got into the 80s, then they I call it their synth cheese phase. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, Claudio Simonetti, he kind of went that route too in the 80s. It's very synthy, right. Very poppy. And
right. That's something we forgot to mention about Runaway, and there's kind of a connection between Runaway and this movie. The DeAngelis Brothers kind of went for their synthy, poppy thing in this movie. Runaway, it was Jerry Goldsmith, which people, you know, he's a big name composer, right. Decided to go down the synth route himself to kind of bad results.
Right.
This is definitely not the DeAngelis best hour.
No.
And when it comes to action soundtracks, I generally prefer them over anybody else.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
So I was really kind of let down that it wasn't a better soundtrack, at least.
It's funny that a lot of the greats in the 80s, because I believe Riz Ortolani did the Fulci sci-fi flick, the post-apocalyptic fact. I'm totally blanking on the name right now.
And that is that the new Barbarians?
New Barbarians was Enzo Castellari, but it's the new Gladiators. That's what it is.
Oh, the new Gladiators. Yes, that's it. I knew it was the new something.
And it's he went that route too. I mean, and obviously he's brilliant. Right. And it was very like, okay, let's bring out the Casio keyboard and write something.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's just, you know, a product of the time that this film and a lot of those films were made in, that kind of music and style was coming in.
Yeah.
You know, it's a shame. I think if the DeAngelis Brothers had been able to, you know, give it a soundtrack that was similar to some of their other work, it may have actually made the movie just at least a nudge better.
Yeah, that is true. And it's I think it just falls into the budgets for Italian films just kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller as time went by. We got into the 80s, and just if you look at the stuff from the late 80s out of Italy, there's some really awful stuff came out around that. There was obviously a few good things that came out too, but there were some really awful movies that came out in the late 80s and from Italy.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, but there's still, I mean, I think Hands of Steel comes from about the same period.
Right.
And that's far and away, that's another title you can get from Cinema de Bizarre, and that is far and away a much better film, in kind of a similar action type of vein.
Right, and I think because, to be totally honest, I think Martino is, I mean, I'll just say it, I think he's a better director than Diodato.
Oh, that's true. I mean, Diodato is more infamous.
Right.
Than Martino, even though Martino has dabbled in some of the same kind of films that that Diodato has. But yeah, I mean, on the whole, Sergio Martino's a much better director. Diodato kind of saw, you know, he's kind of by this time had already made his films, even though I believe right before this he made House on the Edge of the Park, that even though it's a, you know, Last House on the Left remake, basically, I still really kind of enjoy that movie for how crazy David Hess is.
That's one of my favorite films. So, I mean, not to take anything away from Deodato, because he obviously made some pretty good films. That one and Cannibal Holocaust and Jungle Holocaust. And I believe there's a few others that he made before that. So he'd made some Die Like a Man, or, you know, Live Like a Cop, Die Like a Man. And
Die Man, right. Cut and Run's a good one, and that's a similar kind of action title, but it's much better than this.
But I think he was in his comfort zone more with Cut and Run. I think that's the problem with him, is that he's only good at making certain kind of films, where Martino had a lot of range.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I mean, all the Italian directors, or most of them, tried to latch on to whatever came around, whether it would be Sword and Sandals, or, you know, crazy rape films, or cannibal films, or action, which was huge in the early 80s.
Right.
And, you know, some of them did it a lot better than others, and I just don't think Deodato, like you said, he didn't have that range.
Yeah, so this was, I think, a good effort on Deodato's part. It doesn't live up to some of the other early 80s apocalyptic Italian movies.
Yeah, definitely. But still, I mean, if you're a fan of Deodato, if you're somehow strangely a fan of Tony King, which I am, it is worth checking out. But just don't have your expectations up too high.
If this is obviously going to appeal to a certain kind of crowd. So if you like 2019 After the Fall of New York, The New Barbarians, New Gladiators, if you already like those movies, I can't see you watching this and go and hating it.
No, I definitely don't want people to get that impression at all.
No.
But if those other kind of movies don't appeal to you, you can probably just go ahead and skip this one, because it's probably not going to appeal to you either.
Right. Yep.
So, there we have it. That is our bizarre treasure for this week. As always, that can be found on cinemadebizarre.com. That's cinema-de-bizarre.com. And as always, tell them the boys from Sinful Cinema sent you over there. Now we have something new for the show. And that is feedback. We actually finally got a little feedback this episode. This is our first email that we've gotten, so I wanted to read it out in the show and share it for you. It's coming from our good friend Matt Suzaka from Chuck Norris Ate My Baby.
Yay!
And it is titled "You Guys Rock." Oh, and then it says LOL, so I'm not sure what that
means. Ugh!
I know! But here's how it goes. What up, hoes? I'm more of a voicemail kind of guy, but I wanted to drop you a line and say I'm digging the show so far. Plus, you guys gave me a shout-out, so I feel obligated. I'm kidding, of course, but for reals, you guys are off to a great start and making for a solid pairing of massively knowledgeable cult and horror film fans. So I look forward to what you sluts do in future episodes. I like the Fritch horror coverage. I'm a huge fan of many of the films that you mentioned, with Martyrs being the best of the bunch, for me at least. I actually loved Inside, too, but while I love it, I think the people jock it a little too much, many even saying that it's better than Martyrs. Inside's a great entry into the horror genre, but it brought nothing new to horror while Martyrs did. Also, High Tension, I saw it well before it was released in the States, cause I'm fucking cool like that. And while I had issues with the ending, I loved it, mostly because of the opening 25 minutes or so are so intense, and the title of High Tension could never be more fitting. As for Ink, you guys already know how I feel, but it's awesome hearing that you two loved it the same way I did. I've gotten a ton of crazy positive feedback for the film based off my recommendation, which thrills me knowing that people are seeking out something original and creative and enjoying it. What it is about that film that hits you in the gut, I'll never know, but it does, and while it was only number 4 on my top 10 of 2009, it is a film I consider an all-time favorite already, which speaks volumes of its impact. All right, I'm off like a prom dress. Keep it moving, and I can't wait to hear the next episode. And it's signed Dolowite, a.k.a. Matt Suzaka.
Well, thank you, Matt. We definitely feel the same with the, you know, as far as, you know, we think you're a slut and a hoe, too.
Oh yeah, you're a complete hoe, and I can tell that from the fact that you would like us to mention the name of your blog several more times. So that's Chuck Norris Ate My Baby. You can find that at chucknorrisatemybaby.blogspot.com. And it's probably, as it was mentioned on Conversations in the Dark with Mr. Beesol and Matt Suzaka, that is one of the most easy to remember URLs ever.
Yep. Great, great blog name. And I should probably note that Matt's blog, it really, I mean, we're praising it, but it is really good. He has a really unique way of writing, and his blog is very entertaining, and the fact that he always kicks our ass in horror blips is probably well-deserved.
Ah, yes, it probably is. That's probably true. He does have an incredible wit to him. I'm really happy he started a blog this year. I've kind of known of Matt for many years from listening to other podcasts where he would call in and whatnot. I know we are behind the technological curve and not allowing anybody to call in yet, but we are also cheap bastards as well as sluts and hoes.
Mm-hmm.
So we might get around to that in the future, but, you know, I'd have to actually see some emails come in first.
So
thanks very much for writing in, Matt. And if you would like to write into the show, and I know you would, you can write in at sinfulcinema@charter.net. And so send us some emails so we have some more feedback for next week.
And, you know, we should probably add there, if you have some way of recording your message and sending it to us via the email through as an MP3 or something like that, then we will most definitely play it on the show.
Well, that's definitely true. You can send it to our email, or you could either hit us up on Skype. I'm TL Bug on Skype, and if I'm on, I'm generally around.
Aroused?
So, well, maybe. That's for me to know and you to... Never mind. But thanks again, Matt, for being popping our feedback cherry, so to speak. Speaking of aroused, I'll tell you what also gets me aroused is the end of Blaxploitation Month over at Midnight Confession.
Yeah, it is coming to an end here, and I should have that Truck Turner review that I've been talking about for 3 weeks now. hopefully have that up by Friday, and that'll close out the month. I'm also going to do a top 10 list of what I feel are the top 10 blaxploitation movies of all time, and as well as the top 5 blaxploitation soundtracks of all time.
Nice. I can't wait to check that out. That's going to be very fun. I have got coming up in March on the Lightning Bug's Lair, it is the return of You Don't Know Shat, my month-long birthday tribute to William Shatner. So we'll be looking at some interesting films. I think first off, I'm going to have a little film called White Comanche. It's basically the ancient version of Dances with Wolves. So look for that. And also, starting back up in March, you'll be able to check out Hitch on the Hump is going to be returning on Wednesdays. So look for that. I know I got a lot of people that like it when I do the Hitchcock stuff. I've taken a little time off of writing about Hitch, but I'm going to come back starting in March, and I'm going to lead off with Frenzy, which is one of his later films, but one I really like a lot that people don't give props to.
That's a good one. And can we expect a 3-part review on any film coming up there?
I don't think we'll get anything quite as expansive as my Psycho review, but I do have, I've reviewed Frenzy before, but it was before I did Hitch on the Hump, and I don't feel it got quite its due, so that's one that sticks with me, and I'm going to have to go back and talk about it some more, so I'm sure it'll be quite expansive. You know my love for Hitchcock knows almost no bounds.
Oh yeah, Hitchcock is great.
Yes, I'm sure he'll come up on this show at some point or another, because I'll make it happen. And that's about it for this week. Let's leave you with a little teaser of what we're going to be covering next week. We'll be looking at two films from director Mark Savage. What are we going to be looking at, Rev?
Well, we're going to take a look at a couple of his films that they're currently available on as part of a box set with, I believe it's four of his films, I'm not sure, but these are two of them, and it's Marauders from the 80s, which is a shot-on video movie, which, in my opinion, puts some other shot-on-video movies from the 80s to shame. It is just a raunchy, sleazy, violent deliciousness.
Oh, that sounds perfect for this show.
And as well as Sensitive New Age Killer.
It has to be one of the greatest movie titles of all time. If nothing else, I'd love that title.
Yeah, for me, it gets you right at the title. So, yeah, we'll be covering those next week.
Yeah, so next week, come back for that. We'll have something planned for the opening of the show. We don't know what that is, but it'll be awesome. Mm-hmm. And we'll be covering a couple of things for Bizarre Treasures next week, so you'll have to tune in to find out what that's going to be. So I believe that's about it for the show this week. So as always, this is TL Bug saying keep sinning, and from Reverend Phantom.
Later, freaks.
There you go.
Yeah, Spider-Man and Freeze in full effect.
You ready, Ron?
I'm ready.
You ready, dude?
I'm ready, Slick. Are you?
Oh, yeah. Take it down.
Girl, I must warn you. I sense something strange in my mind.
Yeah.
Yo.
Situation is. Let's kill it cause we're running out of time.
Mm-hmm. Tell them, Rick.
It's all so